Marker.
Yes, and come on in.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I have a correction to make from our discussion last night. The correction has to do with what Malka asked about the Levites. I had said that the Levites were counted from the age of 20 to 60. They were actually counted from the age of 1 month to 50, but they could only work in the temple from the age of 30 to 50. So I'd like you to understand that correction.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If there's any further questions on that, please, we can continue with that, or we can go on to verse 282.
We can go on.
All right. We're in section 27 of the Sulam commentary on the Zohar from Parashah Lech Lecha, commencing with Pasuk 282 after our Lashem Yehud. L'shem Yehud Kudsha Barichu Ishkinte Bidkilu Urkimu Udkilu Udkilu Urkimu Le'akta L'shem Yudhe Bavavhe V'yehuda Shalim B'shem Kol Yisrael Limud Torah Mitzvah La'asok Torah Mitzvah V'yehino Amadunai Eloheinu Aleinu Ma'asei Yadeinu Penenei Aleinu Ma'asei Yadeinu Penenehu Rabbi Abba Kadata Mehatam Awa Mahriz Man Bae Otra Uman Bae Orka Dehaye Bialma Deate Yete Vishtadal Theorita Hawo Mit kanshin tule alma lgabeya ravak chad hawa b'shivuteya. Yoma chadata lgabeya amar lo rabbi. Baina lemile bi Ta Kinesha Yeshieli Otra Amar Lo Havadai Amar Lo Mashemecha Amar Lo Yosei Amar Lon Betalmidoi Deikrun Leia Rabbi Yosei Mare Theotra Wikara Yate Vita Sak Theoraita. The translation. After Rabbi Abba returned from Babylon, he declared that whoever desires to be rich and have a long life in the world that is coming should study Torah. And the whole world gathered around him to study Torah. There was a bachelor in his neighborhood. One day he said to Rabbi Abba, "Rabbi, I wish to learn Torah so that I may be wealthy." Rabbi Abba responded, "Why, of course, you shall merit much wealth by studying Torah." And he asked, "What is your name?" And the bachelor responded, "Yossi." Rabbi Abba told his pupils to call the bachelor Yossi, a man of great wealth and glory. And Yossi delved to the study of Torah. My commentary. With Rabbi Ashlag's comments, the pasuk is clear as written. This is an introductory pasuk. Questions, comments, thoughts.
I wonder if Rabbi Abba is thinking of spiritual wealth and the man thinking of physical wealth. I would suppose that Yossi is a nickname or a pet name for Joseph.
And yes.
If so,
that's correct.
Joseph means God will add, God will bless. So I would think that Rabbi Abba saw that in the meaning of his name, too. So
that is also correct. And yes, the man, Yossi, is thinking of physical wealth. And Rabbi Abba is, as we'll come to find out, is not thinking of physical wealth, but he's expecting him to become physically wealthy, as you will come to understand through the rest of the story.
I thought it interesting, too. I just now noticed it. I didn't pick it up when you read it, that Rabbi Abba had just returned from Babylon. So that's given us a time reference.
Well, all of the Zohar is taught after the destruction of the temple.
I have a question. You said the Zohar was taught. It was taught after the destruction of the temple. So where was the Zohar being taught? Was it still in the land, or outside the land, or
the Zohar? The historical story of the Zohar has two different basic stories. Both start with the point that Rabbi Shimon is in the cave in Meron.
Okay.
He and his son are running from the Romans who were attacking them for teaching Torah when they had outlawed the teaching of Torah. So they ran to the cave in Meron. Miraculously, a carob tree grew which normally takes 70 years to bear fruit, grew up overnight. And there was a brook, a stream in the cave. And they studied for 12 years in the cave. They then exited the cave, and they were not yet ready to exit because they couldn't understand how someone could do physical work, could do mundane work.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rabbi Shimon had, through his consciousness being expressed, the light being expressed through his soul through his eyes, he destroyed one farmer. He burned him up. So God said, I don't want you to destroy my world. Go back into the cave. So he went back into the cave and continued his studies for another year. So he was in the cave for 13 years. Both of them were in the cave for 13 years. That was Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Elazar, his son.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they exited, Rabbi Shimon developed seven other students, plus Elazar himself and his father-in-law. So there were 10 students, 10 people studying with him. And they would meet in the cave in Meron, and he would teach orally. Then on the day he died, he instructed Rabbi Abba to be the scribe and to write down his teachings in the Zohar. And those teachings were written down by Rabbi Abba over a 600-year period.
Where was Rabbi Abba?
In Israel. All of the teachings were done in Israel until they were sent to Spain. The scrolls were sent to Spain. The parchment that they had been written on were sent to Spain. Now, in Spain, they were received by Rabbi Moses de Leon, and he proceeded to make copies and sell the copies. So they were spread throughout the Jewish world, the copies, because he was selling them. And he would sell one section or he would sell one parchment. It's not real clear how it was sold. But over the centuries since then, the scrolls were found in different areas of the world. That is one story. The other story is the academics think that Rabbi Moses de Leon in Spain was the author, and he just used Rabbi Shimon's name. The Zohar was never coming out of Babylon, although the scrolls from Rabbi Moses de Leon from Spain did find their way to Babylon. But what this verse is saying, that Rabbi Abbas came from Babylon, we have to understand the Hebrew word for Babylon is Babel. And Babel means chaos, basically. It means confusion, chaos. And so Rabbi Abba is coming from chaos. But he is the person who has written the scrolls. And if you read the scrolls as we are reading them, there is no logic to the Zohar. It jumps subjects. We're looking at section 27, and we've already had three different synopsises. Now, you can't blame that or attribute that to Rabbi Abba, but if you read the Zohar, you become aware that their pattern of writing is not logical.
Not logical, but so many times it's just fitting to the time period or the day.
But why does that happen? You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. But we have to understand why. We have to delve into it. We just cannot accept that it happens that way.
Well, could it be possibly that... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Randy.
Well, could it be possibly that we're living in the world of illusion? When you live in the world of illusion, there's always chaos.
We are living in the world of illusion. And we are living in the world of chaos, because what creates the chaos is the mixing of good and evil. And so that is one of the reasons why the Zohar is written in an illogical manner, jumping from one subject to the next.
Well, that's how our brain perceives stuff. It doesn't stay on one subject matter very long.
You're absolutely correct. And that is why the Zohar is written that way. Because if you accept the first rendition that I gave you, not the academic, but the Rabbi Abba wrote it down, he was writing it from Ruach HaKodesh. From the level of consciousness ordained and connected to Hashem, so that he knew to write it in this way.
Well, what's interesting to me is the fact that you use the numbers 13 and the numbers 10. So he was in God, and then he went back and got in the Sephiroth, and when he got out of the Sephiroth, then he had enough knowledge to come out of the cave and not destroy.
It wasn't 10, it was 12, but yes, you are correct. He needed to have studied 13 years in order to unify with everyone. And what we discussed, I believe it was yesterday, may have been the day before, of how the nation, the current modern state, is in conflict over this issue of does somebody get paid to study Torah, and that's how he supports his family, or does he learn other skills and be able to support his family in a secular world? That discussion has been going on since Rabbi Shimon came out of the cave. Because that was essentially what that midrash that I said today is all about. And I said it once before this week. Rabbi Shimon could not understand how someone could do a mundane task when they had this possibility of being connected to Hashem, and Hashem will provide all that they need. So why take away time for the secular tasks of earning a living and so forth?
Well, when you look at it, time is the most precious commodity that we have. It's not physical things, It's not things that we touch or we own, it's time. And we never have enough time to study all of the Torah or the Zohar that we need.
Randy, what is time?
Time is an illusion.
In the physical world, time is an illusion. But what is... Go ahead, Hannah.
I was going to give her a hint. The distance between time and effect, you know.
Cause and effect, yes.
Cause and effect. Time and effect.
Time is the distance between cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say that we don't have enough time, what you're saying is that you haven't done teshuvah. Because the only purpose for time is to give you that space, that distance between your negative actions and doing teshuvah, so that the effect won't come to you, won't happen to you. So to say that you never have enough time, what you're saying is you're not doing teshuvah. But you are right. Time is the most precious commodity, because it allows us that space, that distance, to be able to do teshuvah. That's Hashem's mercy. That's Hashem's loving kindness.
I was thinking more of time in the reference to our specifically physical selves, in that our selves have limited time and they all have an expiration date. And in that reference, that it seems like there's never enough time to learn everything that you really need to learn.
Does anybody else think that that's true?
Well, I know I've been studying for years. I kind of feel like I wished I had more time to study, let me put it that way. But even though I can pretty much say that I've studied something every day for at least 30, 35 years,
right.
I never feel like I know enough. You know, you just, but then at the same time, like yesterday, I was reading a book. And I got along, I've read the book, at least that portion of the book. And lo and behold, at the bottom of the book, there was an explanation and picture showing you when did the priest light the menorah. And what have we been on, you know, for quite a while is the menorah. So I think Hashem, as our teacher, ultimate teacher, puts the things in our path each day of what we are to learn. And I think at times it's just like sometimes we're tempted to overeat. Well, I think we're tempted to sometimes overstudy, because we don't just live, you know, we do have other duties to do. It's not, you know, you just can't be spiritual on a spiritual to study all day long as you have a job.
Hana, have you ever been in a yeshiva and seen how the chavrutas study?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said. Would you repeat it?
Have you ever been in a yeshiva and seen the way Chevruta study?
No.
Imagine a football field of tables with two chairs next to that, each table. And you have, in that room of the football field of tables, you have two people at each table studying the same thing. Each table is studying something different, because each pair of chevruta, of friends, of study partners, are studying whatever they are studying, and it may not necessarily be the same subject as the table next to them. More than likely, it's not. And they're speaking just across the table, but you have so many tables that the volume of sound is so large. But it's all words of Torah. It's all holiness being imbued into that room. Yes, we need to study Torah day and night. That's the mitzvah. It's not sufficient just to study it the day. We also need to study at night. But the question is, should I stop and pray should I stop my study to pray or not? And there's the discussion in the Talmud over that question. And you know the halakha is to pray three times a day. So you can interrupt your study to pray, according to the rabbis. But there are many other rabbis who say no. You never interrupt study for prayer. But what they're describing is different souls have different tikkunim, different corrections. And so each soul will do what is appropriate for them. And this is the real issue, because people are looking for one simple truth that applies to every human being. And as long as you're looking for that, you're going to be disappointed. Because there are 10 sephirot. And certain souls have reached the level of one of those 10 sephirot. And other souls have reached the level of another of those sephirot. And it's not that they can be talking and studying together or praying together, because they need to be in a frame of reference where they're communicating. There is no one simple truth. So people will say, well, God is the simple truth. Can we ever become God? If you can become God, not God-like, but God, then yes, you can have one simple truth. But for every other human being, it's all relative. And you have to absorb and become the consciousness of, I'm right and they are also right. We're out of time.
Okay.
We'll have questions and answers tonight at the 7 o'clock class, so we can continue with that if you wish. Shalom to all.
Shalom.
Thank you. Thank you.